Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We are down to the final few days of lawmakers' work at Legislative Hall for this year. As they race to June 30th, we thought the time was right to bring back our political analyst to discuss what's happened and what is happening in the General Assembly. So former State Representative Darrell Scott, a Democrat and former state rep, and Newcastle County Council President Tom Kovach join me this week on The Green. Gentlemen, thank you for stopping by.
Tom, thanks for having us.
It's great to be here. Great to join Darrell again.
Well, let's start with the budget, because there is plenty to discuss there. The last DFAC revenue estimates here in June made crafting the budget a little bit easier. Some more revenue found. Lawmakers waited for those numbers before getting down to business this week. So the question I have for you guys is, are they becoming a little too accustomed to the kind of last-minute, quote-unquote, good news from DFAC, and instead of maybe digging in a little bit earlier in the budget process?
Well, I would tell you there are some things that the joint chairs have done over the last year that we need to give them a little bit of credit. So they've been looking at the long-term issues and challenges that we have from a budget perspective and had meetings, you know, off session and trying to dig into and look at long-term solutions. So I think that what they were dealing with is bad news, bad news, bad news, and hoping for some good news. And they got a little bit of it at the end of session. But I know when Tom was there and I was there that the budget was presented earlier. And I think this year is a little bit of an anomaly that they were just it was just bad news and they were hoping for some good news to help them out. And they got a little bit of relief.
Tom?
Yeah. And as Darrell mentioned, I thought there was a movement in a very positive direction to require and as a policy practice, get the budget out early, because that can make all the difference in the world. And, you know, not to take away any credit to, you know, the JFC and the hard work that they have to do. But, you know, yeah, it's like, well, we're waiting for salvation. Oh, we get some. So it's not going to be as bad as we thought. But darn it, we know these numbers are going to be bad. And, you know, at a certain point, we really have to face the music. I mean, it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad next year. We kind of keep putting off making these decisions that might be painful for 1 year, for another year, for another year. Gosh, it is going to be bad for the foreseeable future. We do not have the revenue that's coming in. The sheets do continually decreasing. We have absolutely got to make those painful decisions. I was hoping, in a nonpartisan way, I was hoping that in an off, you know, election year, right, we could have had some of those changes made. Instead, I don't see it.
Which brings me to my next point, which is, I mean, there are some tough choices that have to be made just to get through this year before we get to next year. But there was no real support for Governor Markell's cut to the senior tax subsidy, which was, in the governor's words, an effort to kind of deal with immediate revenue issues, but also look at a long-term issue of the graying of Delaware's population. Instead, even this week, we see, you know, JFC zeroing out ag and farmland preservation, maybe taking $2 million from grant and aid, clawing back some of the county's shares of the realty transfer tax. Do those all sound to you guys more like Band-Aid solutions?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. First of all, giving the governor credit where credit is due, he does put out some significant thoughts and significant possibilities for reducing the budget going forward. You question the way he goes about this and the communication that goes on with the legislature, even or especially his own party that's in charge of the own legislature. I mean, a year ago we heard gas tax, and, you know, Pete Schwarzkopf said, well, we can't spell gas tax. Well, when the Speaker of the House says that about a governor's initiative, clearly there hasn't been the communication necessary. Darrell?
Yeah, and Tom, I think that the issue is, or to your question, many of the solutions being proposed right now are short term, right? They're using one-time money from the settlement to try and fill gaps. And, you know, likely what we'll likely see is money from the settlement being used as cash to the bond bill if there's any left to be done. So, again, it'll go toward investments that we need to have made, and it'll go to investments for our community, whether it be CTF, community transportation fund money, municipal street aid money, and projects of that nature. But it doesn't go to the foundational issues that we have in that, you know, a significant portion of our revenue comes from other people's money. And you take the casino and the declining revenue, and that's not been anybody. That's not a surprise to anybody. A sheet peaking at over $500 million and knowing that that gravy train can't continue forever, and a realization with some legislation that was passed to try and secure that funding source for years to come. but at a smaller level.
Right.
And so we've got to find a way to address long term the revenue needs that the revenue that we need for this state to fund critical services.
I do want to talk a little bit more about next year in a moment, but first I do want to touch on the Transportation Trust Fund and infrastructure spending and those type of things. Last year, as Tom, you mentioned, you know, the governor put out the gas tax plan that fell. So this year he's kind of stayed out of the debate and said, hey, you guys, tell me what you want to do. Democrats have pushed a DMV fee package through the House. Its fate in the Senate still somewhat uncertain as Republicans are looking for some concessions there to get their support. Do you think the DMV fees can get done? And more importantly, perhaps, if it doesn't, you know, what's the plan C now, I guess, in this effort to fund roads, bridges, and such?
Well, Tom, last year, again, there was a proposal by the governor to have an additional tax, and that would be paid for in the form of people buying gasoline, and that cost would be added on to the consumer. Again, an interesting proposition, but a way to generate revenue. Because people recognize the need to generate revenue for transportation improvements. Instead, the exact opposite was the result, as $40 million was taken out of the Transportation Trust Fund and no way to fund, you know, these critical projects that we're facing. You've absolutely got to reform that system. You know, it is broken. I think it is a bipartisan agreement that the system we have for funding our transportation infrastructure in Delaware is absolutely broken, not kind of a little messed up, broken.
Mm-hmm.
Legislators are occasionally given some small amount of funding to make, you know, 18 constituents happy, you know, when more than half of their roadways are inadequate within their districts. That is not an adequate system for addressing our problems. As Daryl said, you need to find a way to address this problem, whether it's increasing revenue or whether it's decreasing expenditures so that we have money to pay for this transportation improvements, which are so desperately.
Because even the DMV fees are kind of nibbling on the edges, right? I mean, that's.
Well, they are, but I understand it's expected to generate $25 million mm-hmm. in revenue. So that's material, right? And allow for $25 million in additional borrowing. So it could be result in $50 million in additional investment. But I mean, part of it speaks to, you know, there's this resistance to raise fees that haven't been raised in years. And the reality is costs go up. I mean, talk to some senators who own businesses. I mean, Senator Hawker, right? I'm sure milk has gone up over the 20 years that that he's been selling milk, right? And Danny Short, from an insurance perspective, that insurance rates have gone up. So, I mean, business reality, if you want to run like a business and sort of use that comparison, is that costs go up. We need to increase the costs associated with providing those services. And it's unfortunate that we've waited so long for some of these fees to go up.
We talked a lot about next year, you know, in the 2017 budget. We talk about $150 to $170 million. Democrats have looked at the possibility of creating some new brackets at the higher end to bring some revenue in. Republicans have talked about, doing more on the spending side, creating a committee much like the revenue committee we had this year to look at the spending side. Is it fair to say that there is kind of a big battle perhaps looming? And as Tom, I think you've alluded to, this is in an election year trying to get this type of work done.
I think, you know, again, we have a big hole looming. So, look at past history. Have taxes ever been raised in advance of a particular potentially, you know, need? I don't think the political appetite is there still to raise taxes. And again, if we do, what are we saying to, quote, top earners in this state over, you know, $50,000, $60,000 is that, hey, we need you to fund more of our state's efforts versus we're looking about increasing revenue through business growth or we're looking to, you know, decrease spending. It's really – there's a point on that curve where raising taxes and fees doesn't become effective. And we've missed our lessons from raising the cigarette tax. We raised the cigarette tax to be comparable to other states. All of a sudden, we got less money in cigarette tax. That can happen and will happen with other taxes and fees when we raise them too high. I think it would be a mistake to raise income taxes at this point. Again, that's punting on addressing the solutions that Daryl, you and I were talking about.
Yeah, I will tell you, I was surprised that, again, in an off election year, this is the year that typically the tough decisions
right.
are being made. And it doesn't appear that a vote on changing in tax rates is going to come about. So, again, it's going to be even tougher next year. But I think you have to look at tax policy, and I know that there was a proposal to say, hey, let's add a bracket or two at the top end. I know that there was some refinement of that policy to say, let's look at our tax policy, make sure it's progressive and not regressive. There may be some adjustments down in some of the lower income brackets, providing the middle class some additional dollars to be able to just survive, right?
Right.
And I think we could all agree that $60,000 really shouldn't be the top end of the income bracket, right? What should it be, right? Is it? I think the proposal was $125,000 and $250,000, right. And saying, hey, can you afford to pay a little bit more in taxes and can we still be competitive as a state? I think the answer is yes.
All right. We're going to take a brief pause here, take a break, and when we come back with our political analysts, Darrell Scott and Tom Kovach, we'll discuss some other issues at Lake Hall. That's in just a moment. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Continue our conversation with our political analyst, former Democratic State Representative Darrell Scott, and former State Rep and Newcastle County Council President, Republican Tom Kovach. Gentlemen, thanks again for being with us this week. We spent the first segment on the budget, but there are some other issues that are out there. Let's start with education, which has really dominated things this year. Opt-outs, some redistricting of maybe Wilmington, charter school moratorium. We mentioned JFC, and there's maybe some money being taken away from ongoing Race to the Top initiatives. But really across the board, all these things very contentious, which begs the question, is there a sense that education, or at the very least education policy, is a bit broken right now in this state?
I think education policy is a very personal issue. And so you've got 62 people in the General Assembly that have an opinion about it. And talking with Chairman Jakes about the House Education Committee, I think he's had 50 bills come through or some significant number. So there are lots of ideas about how to reform or change, discontinue programs within the education policy. And I think that I see education as a constantly changing and evolving ecosystem, right? And what we have to do is not be afraid to slow down and allow things time to work without continuing to impose change on the system. And I think at times we've been too aggressive, making too many changes and then trying to figure out what is working and what's not. It's sort of a cause and effect, right? How can I tell what's having an effect when I've got so many things moving at the same time?
Tom?
I'd like to be an optimist, but let's be honest. I think our education system is very dysfunctional at present. The enrollment at charter schools is an absolute clear sign of that parents and students aren't happy with the public education system. Now, that being said, public education is about the most difficult business that you could ever be in. You have no idea who's going to come. You have to take, as a business, you have to take everybody that walks in your door and then provide them with a top-notch education. That's what we demand as a public. We have to allow initiatives and change to take place at the local level. Currently, our structure does not allow that. It's a very top-down command structure that doesn't allow flexibility at the local level because we want accountability at the state level. And that model isn't working and it's not producing the results we need. So we need to decide, are we going to trust local schools and give that power to them or not?
To your point, Darren, when you talked about the idea that maybe there needs to be some time and some things just to settle in and people kind of get a grasp on what's going on and what's working and what's not working. With that in mind, and with the fact that things are so contentious right now, is it fair to say at this point that there's going to be a problem getting anything done during the remainder of the Markell administration?
I think new initiatives will be challenging to put forth. I think that what I see and what I read about is a lot of tweaking, right, mm-hmm. or modifications, right? And I'll say it's also let's stop, right? Let's stop doing things. Let's stop testing, right? Which is, I mean, the whole discussion around opt-out, I have to say, has just been I just have found it to be unproductive. It's unfortunate that parents have, if there is a need, they have an ability to opt their child out, right? And for some sponsors of the bill to say that their purpose in opting out is to sort of invalidate the test with no alternative in place is just, I mean, I see it as an accountability, right? So as a legislator, I was hoping to advance policy and hold those that I gave money, and we give over $1 billion to our public education system, accountable. And it gave us the ability to measure student achievement up and down the state in every school, right? And I don't see an alternative being proposed for that that particular issue. And again, the objective seems to be against something and not advocating for.
Yeah, and I think the problem, some of that comes from, and let's identify there, the political problem. This, again, is not necessarily a partisan problem. I think there are Democrats and Republicans alike that would love to see major improvements in our school system. Maybe, you know, not agree fully on how we get there. You know, but let's take the political reality that there is one advocacy group out there that's organized and has funding and that deals with the education issue, and it's a teachers union. And a teachers union, while I can't tell you – my wife's a teacher. I can't tell you how much I respect teachers. Their job and their fiduciary duty is to look out for teachers. While that overlaps with the needs of the students sometimes, it does not in others. And, you know, that can't be the only player. And I like the fact that parents are paying attention and frustrated and want to do something. Now, I think opting out, quite frankly, from a personal level, might be a misdirection of that frustration, but it's an expression of that frustration. And thank goodness. And now grab all those parents that sign up to opt out and say, get involved and stay involved in the process, because we need another advocacy group at the table other than the teachers union.
Let's run through a couple of things real quick. Marijuana decriminalization was passed, signed by the governor. Is that a fairly significant thing to happen in this state at this juncture?
I think it is. I think it's, again, it's not to the extent that Colorado took and some of the other states have taken. But again, our court systems are clogged with, I'll say, people caught with small amounts of marijuana and then faced with a criminal conviction on their record that prohibits them or limits their ability to get jobs and provide for their families. So I think that the decriminalization was a good first step. And I think that there were, if I were there, I would have advocated for, again, we've got young people that were excluded that still are now going to be exposed to a criminal conviction and have to go through an expungement process. And Tom, you know better than I about sort of the link that it will take. But so I think it's a good first step.
Tom?
Decriminalization is unfortunately like being half pregnant. It's still illegal, but we're going to hit you with a fine with it instead. You know, I personally don't like it at all, and not because I'm against the potential legalization of marijuana. You know, it's because we're saying, hey, it's illegal, but we're going to give you a fine for it. I absolutely agree that, you know, young people or people that commit nonviolent drug-related offenses, especially marijuana-related offenses, that is a significant problem to our society to criminalize their record and to prevent them from getting jobs and moving forward. And again, it's a waste of our money for in the prisons. That result of the bill I like, but it is absolutely significant, and it kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, we were talking about oils and marijuana oils, and all of a sudden the decriminalization came up, kind of snuck in out of public attention and passed.
And seeing that did pass, while other things such as, you know, physician-assisted suicide, death penalty, adding e-cigs, those things faced bigger hurdles. Really the only one that got through was adding e-cigs to the indoor smoking ban. It doesn't seem like this has been a year that you've been able to get a lot of these more controversial things moved forward.
It's going to be interesting when they sit back and look at what the accomplishments of the session are. I mean, they'll point to decriminalization and they'll point to balancing the budget. But beyond that, it'll be interesting to see what we count as highlights from this session. To your point, death penalty sort of faced the same fate that when I was trying to advance that issue. The good thing is we've got another year of this General Assembly. So they'll have an opportunity to potentially continue to look to advance that. The assisted suicide. I think introducing the bill and beginning the public debate, that is one. And even when I was serving and talking to constituents who raised the issue to me, I wasn't ready and prepared to have that conversation. It's a very tough policy issue. It's a personal issue, right, as you deal with that and trying to figure out where you stand on that from a public policy standpoint.
That's a political reality, Daryl. And Tom, I agree. You generally don't get a controversial bill passed the first time. I mean, anti-discrimination took, 10 years of virtually the same bill, and then all of a sudden the right time, the bill's there at the right time, the right place, and passed, and our kids are going to be like, well, what took you so long? But to Daryl's point, even if all these had been accomplished, what did we accomplish for the long run for our state, for putting us as a government in the place to survive and be sustainable?
And another issue that kind of wasn't addressed that we've been talking about for some time is the casinos and what's going to be done with them. We've had a task force that's been kind of looking at this for the better part of 2 years, made some recommendations this year, and then all of a sudden it's totally off the radar.
They don't have any money, right? I mean, the issue is, am I going to provide concessions that will allow the industry to survive and provide revenue to the state at the tune of, you know, I don't know what it was, $30 or $40 million
yeah.
dollars, and then and they don't have that $30 or $40 million dollars. So to take it out of the revenue stream and add, you know, sort of pile it on was extremely difficult. But again, it's an issue I know locally Senator Bushwiller was advocating and sort of trying to advance that, and understands clearly that the challenge that we, the General Assembly, and I'll put myself in that vote, and Tom, I don't know if you were there too, is when we raised the taxes, right? We mm-hmm. have made a number of adjustments from 2009 and backing down gross receipts and PIT and other changes that we made, and we've not touched the change and the increase that we made to the casino.
Yeah, the casino issue, I think, did get dropped again. When it was first passed, and when we first passed it, I personally was against some of the high rates that were assessed to the casino. You know, from the perspective, you're going to give a business a license to operate, and quite frankly, state granted a limited monopoly to three businesses to operate. It really charged them a rate that was unsustainable for their growth. If you're going to have a business, let it succeed in the state. You know, not to give any tax breaks, but the rates charged these casinos are well above and beyond any other business in the state. And why did we ever limit the license to the three casinos if there was another business that would want to invest in it, say in Wilmington? I wouldn't have financially invested in that business, but gosh, if there was and there were, why wouldn't we have as a state adopted a system that revenue then could have been shared?
Daryl Scott, Tom Kobach, thank you so much for your time and insight this week here on The Green.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As always, you can follow our political reporter James Dawson's coverage of the General Assembly in his legislative updates on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, or online at DelawarePublic.org. Stay with us. We have our latest edition of History Matters next. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. This month in History Matters, we continue our look at the Nanticoke tribe in Delaware. In our last segment, we told you the story of Levin Sockham, a Nanticoke business owner who historians and tribal members say was persecuted when he became too successful. In 1855, a court of law ruled that he was mulatto, meaning part black, and couldn't sell gunpowder or even own a gun. Sockham ended up moving to New Jersey, where race laws at the time were more relaxed. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Ann Hoffman explores what happened to the descendants of the Nanticoke that stayed, including the tribe's current chief.
My name is William Daisy, and my Native American name is Thunder Eagle, and I'm chief of the Nanticoke Indian Tribe of Delaware.
Chief Daisy was born in 1931 in Millsboro. Back then, he says, transportation was just Model Ts and horse and buggies. So the farming town in southern Delaware where he grew up felt a million miles away from bustling Wilmington or even Dover.
We were taught how to hunt, fish, make bow and arrows, rabbit traps. We were taught how to, which berries to pick, which fruit was edible.
Families back then passed on what are called lifeway traditions, curing illnesses with old remedies and using Native American ways to gather more food than just that year's harvest. From the time he could walk, Chief Daisy was learning.
We had to clam and fish. We learned how to clam with our, catch clams with our feet. The water wasn't polluted then, so you felt the clam on the bottom. You reached down and picked it up, and how to spear fish, how to shoot them with bow and arrow.
All the Nanticoke families were close. They lived near the Indian Mission Church and an Indian schoolhouse. Like in any small community, the chief couldn't even look at a girl without some auntie noticing.
Sometimes it's like a little patent place. Everyone knew what everyone else was doing, who had what, who was going with who, and you know, how long it had been going. They knew. We didn't use the drums, but communication was very effective.
And of course, once a year they did gather around a drum for their powwow on Chief Clark's land.
Powwow is like a homecoming. You met relatives you hadn't seen in quite a while because they come from all over the country and they were scattered now. And of course, kids had a ball because we were running around everywhere and eating all we could eat and then playing with each other.
Before the chief was born in the 1920s, the Nanticoke powwows were big events. Sometimes state dignitaries made an appearance to celebrate. Anthropology students came to take notes. Newspapers from Wilmington, Philadelphia, and Baltimore sent photographers. They wrote sensationalist headlines like, "Indians in Native Garb Entertain at Powwow."
I can remember seeing an article in the Philadelphia paper back in the 1920s that said something about wild Indians come together to celebrate, you know, and that just irked me.
Sterling Street, a tribal elder, says those depictions in the newspaper didn't just annoy, they shamed people in the tribe. They weren't wild, they were farmers and Christians and members of the community. So when Chief Daisy was little, the powwows he went to were held in secret. No outsiders were allowed in. Leaving the protective nest of the tribe could be scary. Life on the outside was complicated. Nanticoke elders had made sure years before that kids had their own schools, but that didn't protect them from the other children.
And sometimes if we were walking to school, the kids who were on the white school bus in which transportation would provide would taunt us. They would tease us. You know how kids are. Sometimes they'd be really mean. They would tease us as they passed us. They stuck their tongue out and laughed and waved. And they used half-breed and things like that. Used. It was really hurt, you know.
Elder Sterling Street says it was the same way at the local movie theater.
The blacks and the Indians had to sit upstairs. And if you could pass for white, they would do that, and they would sit downstairs.
The discrimination wasn't consistent from person to person because Nanticoke people all look different. In Chief Daisy's home in Dover, the walls are filled with graduation photos, wedding portraits, and pictures of family reunions. Some of the faces in the frames look white or black, mixed race, or Native American. And while people in Millsboro got it a little more, like they knew that if you had a certain last name, you were an Indian and you did go to underground powwows, Daisy says the state of Delaware was still denying his Indian heritage.
State of Delaware wanted to classify all Native Americans as black. We have a census every 10 years, and they instructed the census taker to do not put Native American on any census report, put anything else except Native American. Mulatto was a favorite term to use. But you could be classed colored, Negro, mulatto, in some cases white, depending on if you were light enough. He wasn't sure. Sometimes he'd put white.
And outside of their little town, Nanticoke people were treated just as black people were in the Jim Crow South.
We knew as kids we were not allowed to go on the rides in Rehoboth.
We had to go swimming down by the Cape Henlopen Hotel.
Historian Gabby Tyak from the National Museum of the American Indian says Nanticoke people were classified as black by default.
So if you're at the amusement park and you are a brown-skinned person and Indians are not supposed to exist, then you're not in the category of white. You know, it's you have to fall into one thing or the other.
In the 1960s, Chief Daisy moved to Oakland, California with his wife and their kids. There they discovered the American Indian movement and black power. Historian Gabby Tyak says this was a moment when Native people from the Eastern Seaboard could regain some of their old ways from Western tribes like the Ojibwe and Lakota, who had made contact later.
It was about going out to visit and people from the West coming here. It really awakened people here.
At the time, people from Western tribes had heard stories of Wounded Knee from their grandparents. Some of them had even been born in teepees. They were able to pass on their knowledge to Nanticoke people. And at the same time, the United States was changing. Schools in southern Delaware finally desegregated, although years after schools in the rest of the U.S. When schools did desegregate, Nanticoke people started holding their powwows in public again. And this time, anyone could come. Last fall's Nanticoke powwow drew over 30,000 people.
I think what's important to focus on is how miraculously beautiful it is, how strong they've been, and how persistent they've been over centuries and centuries to keep that tribal identity. I mean, there's been so much pressure to change, to assimilate, to leave.
Chief Daisy says he never could have imagined how much things would change back when he was a kid. when his parents told him never to expect to get a good job, back when he had to tell his little kids why they couldn't swim on the white beach at Rehoboth. In those days, he didn't buy into his civics teacher's lessons about equality and the Constitution.
And I think this country is moving towards fulfilling its promise as far as that is concerned. I had no idea that I would ever see a black president. It's restored my faith in this country.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Thanks, Ann. A reminder that History Matters each month is produced in collaboration with the Delaware Historical Society. And stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at a traveling version of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that's coming to the First State. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Since its dedication in 1996, the Wall That Heals has visited over 400 U.S. cities and towns. Beginning July 2nd, the half-scale replica of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial will be on display at Kent County Veterans Memorial Park in Dover for 4 days. Like the permanent memorial in Washington, D.C., the display bears the names of the more than 58,000 servicemen and women who gave their lives in the Vietnam War. And the exterior of the trailer that carries it opens into a mobile education center featuring exhibits on the war. Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter recently spoke with Dave Skosik of the Delaware chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America about the traveling memorial.
Dave, the Wall That Heals is about 250 feet in length, so it's a half-scale model of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. But the emotions are still just as powerful, I would imagine, when people see the Wall That Heals.
That's exactly accurate, Kathy. I've been to the memorial in D.C. several times, and when people walk up to it, you may have several hundred people there, and it's like being in church. People are quiet. People are lost in reverie. Some are Tracy Dames. Some will actually put mementos at the base of it. Some actually will do the same thing when the traveling wall comes. It is, as you mentioned, half the size, but it's still two legs. They're each 125 feet in length, and people can trace names for everything that they do in the memorial in D.C.,
Tell us about the process of setting up the Wall That Heals.
Well, actually, the process begins about a year and a half out where you request it because it's very much in demand. It will arrive in two tractor trailers. One is an education center. The other has the actual memorial in it. They require about 15 people to help set it up, so we've been working on that. We'll have the folks there. So it will be open and ready to go on the morning of July 2nd, which is Thursday. We'll have a ceremony at 10 a.m., at the Kent County Memorial Park. We anticipate a lot of folks there. We've been getting the word out. It was in Delaware, I'm guessing about 15 years ago, down at Legislative Mall. And they had the opportunity for people to actually read the names. And that's what we're going to do, too. We're allowing people to sign up, to spend a half hour reading the names. We're going to try to include all 58,300-plus names. So out of respect for that, that's what we intend to do. It'll be open 24 hours a day.
I imagine that for some folks, it's very tough to get to Washington, D.C. to see the wall, not just geographically, but kind of emotionally.
That's exactly right. You may see people standing there and they don't know what to say. Some will clearly have a lump in their throat. Some will be tracing names. And I believe we will see the same thing to a limited extent here when it comes to Dover. It's a cathartic effect for a great many people, regardless of what side you're on politically during that conflict.
Along with the wall itself, there's a mobile education center. So you'll have photos of service members and exhibits that the young people can learn more about the Vietnam War.
Exactly right. It is an important part of our history. And in fact, it shapes our engagement today. People were obviously split on many sides during that conflict. The argument was, well, it was a political war. Yeah, to some extent, every war is a political war. I think most Vietnam veterans would like people to know that when we left after the ceasefire was signed in 1973, the lights were on. We turned the country over to a democratic government in South Vietnam, and it was more than 2 years later that after we were gone that the North invaded in violation of the Paris Peace Accords. So some say, well, we lost that war. Well, no, we didn't lose it. The will was not there to give the South Vietnamese the assistance that we had promised them. And I understand people were war weary. But a big part of it is that Vietnam veterans were essentially, to a great extent, blamed for the war. People who had been drafted in many instances. And that was a stigma that was hard for many veterans. To this day, there's a bitterness there.
Perception has since changed for the most part.
They have, but it has changed. I think a big part of that, Kathy, has to do with the founding of the Vietnam Veterans of America back in 1987. And one of the goals, in fact, the national slogan became, never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. But I know many veterans who were told, when you get off of that airplane in California, change. Do not walk into that terminal with your uniform on, change into civvies, because in some cases people were spit on, yelled at, cursed at, had things thrown on them. And that was very difficult for somebody coming out of the jungle who had done his best to fight for our country. Because of our experiences, we take that to heart. Never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. And that goes both ways, whether it's World War II veterans or to our current veterans, who we very much appreciate. And at the forefront, the Vietnam Veterans of America have been there attending rallies, attending funerals, doing what they can to raise funds, to raise visibility for our current generation of patriots and their families.
Can you take us back to the first time that you visited the Vietnam Memorial?
Oh, boy. It was difficult. It was, I believe, 1982 is when it was dedicated, and it was a couple of years that I kind of put it out of my mind. As they say, some people say it was just a big black gash in the ground, but when you see it, it has a whole different effect, a whole different impact. And the way that the names are on there, it's chronologically. So on the left side, you'll see the first person who died there in 1959, all the way through the end of the conflict. And they have books, and you can go through and find out exactly where the name that you're looking at is, and go down there, and they say people trace it. It's not just Vietnam veterans there. You will see all generations down there. That, well, I've been there about three or four times. It makes you remember. It makes you think back, and particularly if there's names on there who you knew.
I've been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., but I've also seen the replica, and it was just as moving.
Absolutely. It was down in southern Delaware. I want to say Seaford rather than Georgetown. It's Seaford. Time slips by, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I went down for that, and I signed up to read the names. And I think I filled three slots because I wanted to make sure that I got to recite the name of my sister's fiancé who was killed over there.
The Wall That Heals and the visit to Dover is the result of a partnership between the Delaware Commission of Veterans Affairs and the VVA, Chapter 850, who will be hosting the memorial. And you worked with them to get the Memorial Park in Kent County underway.
They gave us an acre and a half back in 2007, and they said, do us proud. And we have done them proud. We built the memorial to the Vietnam Memorial, dedicated that in 2009. It was all private money. We got it by selling bricks. Then we 3 years later, dedicated a Gold Star Mother and Families Memorial to all generations of families who have lost someone. And we dedicated a Korean War Memorial last year. And we're working on a Middle East Conflicts Memorial right now.
Dave, you mentioned that the Memorial Park in Kent County
was
put together with private donations.
Yes.
And actually more than $8 million was raised to build the wall in Washington, D.C. That says something.
It really does. I think it started to, people start thinking about it, whether it was a conscious thing, whether it was a recollection. Hey, remember when? And they go, wow, you know. I remember reading Tom Brokaw's book about the 60s, and I thought he underemphasized the people who actually served in uniform. He talked about the generation who, went their own way, the hippie generation and the demonstrations and all that. But the folks who were actually allowed themselves to be drafted and went over there and faced death on a daily basis, to me, just like today, they are the heroes. I'm a retired military. I served in three branches, the the Air Force, the Army National Guard here in Delaware, and finally the Navy Reserve in D.C. and the Pentagon. And I remember the third level, there was at least back in 07 when I retired, a big case about 15 feet long and a big banner behind it. It said every generation has its heroes. This one is no different. Many of these folks have just gone on multiple tours away from their families, in harm's way. We need to make sure that we take care of these folks. A lot of people who have never had to worry about whether there would be somebody rapping on a door 3 o'clock in the morning because they said something that wasn't appropriate on a radio station like this or on television or wrote a letter to the editor, which is in great many parts of the world today. But people who've never traveled anywhere but here they kind of take it for granted. So we think that we just want to remind them of this, of the sacrifices that are made. Because very simply, Kathy, fewer than 1% of Americans actually put their right hand up to enlist. So we, in a very real sense, in terms of warriors who protect us and allow us to live our lives here, we're looking at the cream of the crop in a very real sense.
Our thanks to Dave Skosik of the Delaware chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America. The Wall That Heals is at the Kent County Veterans Memorial Park in Dover beginning next Thursday. And next on The Green, this week's Enlighten Me. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. On the heels of the mass shooting that killed 9 people at a historic black church in South Carolina, a Sussex County town is taking its own steps to heal. They're working to preserve the Richard Allen School in Georgetown, which served as a center of African-American community for nearly a century, but hasn't been a functioning school in several years. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek tells us locals hope to see it reopened in a new form, just as an official state historic marker was unveiled outside the building last week to celebrate its past.
I don't feel no ways hard.
Just past the railroad tracks in Georgetown, Harry Crapper is ringing in a new chapter of his old school's history.
Lord have mercy. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
Crapper was there with other alumni and Delaware leaders to unveil a state historic marker at Richard Allen and to celebrate the hard work that's gone into preserving this shuttered landmark.
This school helped me to be the man that I am today. You got to have a foundation, and this school was my foundation.
Richard Allen is one of the few remaining DuPont schools, started by philanthropist Pierre Samuel DuPont in the 1920s for Delaware's African-American youth. At the time, they had few options for getting an education, and Crapper says even the DuPont schools had their struggles.
We used to get books and everything from the other school, and half of them would have the pages tore out, would have the backs tore off them, and we had to learn what little bit we could learn from those books. But even though with all of that, we still had lawyers and judges to leave the school. And that was because our teachers thought enough of us to make us learn.
90-year-old Eunice Richardson says the same thing. She's a longtime local mentor and educator who was one of the first students in the Little Brick Schoolhouse.
When I went, there's always 2 rooms here, 2 school rooms, but each room had 4 classes, but only 1 teacher in all of it. And I think our restrooms were outside then, and we had wood stoves for heat.
Richard Allen was a peaceful place, she says, where every kid got a hot meal, and if you misbehaved, word traveled fast in the neighborhood.
We learned from home that if you messed up in school, you're going to get a spanking when you got home, so it was best to be good.
The school only went up to 8th grade, and for most black kids, segregation meant leaving Georgetown for high school. But former student Darrell Melvin says Richard Allen was always a focal point for African Americans in Sussex County.
This was like home here. It's the school, the area, the community, everything was as one back then. So we played ball, we played football. I learned to play football right in that field right there. We played baseball, and people came from different towns. They all came here. So it was like this was the central location for everything. And that's what we remember. That's why we said we wanted it so bad, because that unity needs to come back.
Melvin is part of the Richard Allen Coalition, which spent years working with the Delaware Public Archives and state legislators to secure the historic marker for the school. Next, they want to renovate and reopen the building as a multicultural community center to carry on the school traditions that Coalition historian Christy Taylor says began at neighboring Prospect AME Church.
It really apparently was a school at the church earlier than the school being built by DuPonts. So there was always a there was always something going on in this community related to what we're trying to do now, education, arts, you know, religion.
Taylor and her brothers all attended Richard Allen, too. The brothers became civil rights lawyers, and Taylor is a music and dance teacher, soon, she hopes, at the school itself. And with racial tensions in the spotlight after a string of well-publicized police shootings of black people and a suspected hate crime in South Carolina where a white gunman is charged with killing 9 black AME churchgoers, Taylor says it'll be vital to open the Allen School's doors to everyone.
This is a real healing what is happening, and the more we can do, you know, religious or not, it's about love. It's about just what we're doing now, talking about the history. We should know everyone's history. I really believe strongly it's not just serving one community. I think that's maybe how we can really open up and get rid of the fear and the ignorance between ourselves as humans.
When the school reopens, the Coalition wants to fill it with mementos from its rich history. That means books and papers kept by folks like Agnes Ingram Williams, who went to the school in the 30s and 40s. She grew up across the street and now lives there again.
There was so much fun as being 6 or 7. I'd stand there, hear that bell, and by the time she was ringing that second one, I'd be dipping under her and in my seat when she came in. So that was one of the experiences.
Ingram went to high school in Wilmington after Richard Allen and then on to college in Maryland, then into the civil service at Dover Air Force Base for 32 years. She became an engine manager there before retiring, and all thanks to humble beginnings and a close-knit community back at home.
We were poor, and if we were poor, we didn't know it. Because everybody, it was, as they say, you need a village. It was just great. And I'm so thankful that I'm here at this time, and I can see where we have traveled from.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Annie Ropeek in Georgetown.
Thanks, Annie, for enlightening us this week. And that's all for The Green this week. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. If you have something to say about this week's show or want to offer a story idea for future shows, you can contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE. Or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, our political analysts, Tom Kovac and Daryl Scott, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Ann Hoffman, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.